Good evening. Welcome to the annual English Department Creative Writing Awards Student Reading. My name is Gordon Henry, and I'm a faculty member in the English Department here. And before we begin the reading, I'd just like to acknowledge the work of some of our faculty who worked with many of the students you'll hear reading tonight. And so I'd like to thank Diane Wachowski and Robin Silverglide, our poets in the English Department, for their work, and William Penn for his work with the fiction writing students, Marcia Aldrich for her continual good work with the creative nonfiction students, and Jeff Ray and Bill Vincent for their work with the screenwriting students. And I also want to acknowledge Jim Porter, who's worked with many of these students over the course of the past couple of years as well, and mostly in fiction writing. Finally, I'd like to thank also all the students who submitted to the awards this year. We had a bigger pool of awards and our submissions this year than we've had in the past couple of years, and so it was good to see students getting back into the flow of submitting a work for these awards. And it's very competitive, and I'd like to thank, in that vein, the judge Richard McCann of American University, who judged the fiction, poetry, and creative nonfiction, and Chuck Farr, who judges screenwriting submissions. I'm going to start by, again, announcing the winners in each category, and then we'll move into the reading, and we're going to start with an order of the reading. All the third-place winners will read, and then the second-place winners, and then the first-place winners. So, well, just let me remind you of the winners in poetry. The first-place winner was Leslie Anderson for her works Meeting of the Worm Shepherds, Michigan Inaugural, and Eulogy for Spirit and Opportunity. So the second-place winner in poetry was Ian Brown for his poems Footprints, Mike, and Poetry. And third went to Leah Greenwell, who also won for Best Single Poem, and the poems that she submitted were Rebirth, Pastels, and The Picture of Lake Michigan That Hangs on My Wall. For fiction, the first-place winner is Nicole Taylor for her work In the Valley. Second place went to Brittany Baker for Kicking Sawdust. And third place to Catherine Blake for The Amazing Adventures of Jake and Binkers, The Lost Bunny. And for creative nonfiction, first place went to Lindsay Sloan, who will not be with us tonight, but we're going to have somebody read a little bit of her work in her place. Second went to Kelly Hannon for The Dead Dad Essay. Third to Jill Kolongowski for Breaking. And in screenwriting, we had Megan Pollum for her work Cassidy, Vanessa Sikos for Scarred, and Ashley Chapman for Heroes and Villains. Excuse me. And so I'd like to start then with our third place winners. We'll go in this order. Jill Kolongowski will read creative nonfiction. Then Catherine Blake will read fiction, Leah Greenwell poetry, and Ashley Chapman screenwriting, if she's here. Some of the people won't be here, so. So Jill will start us off tonight with creative nonfiction.
Hi, everybody. My name's Jill. I'm going to only read a part of my essay because it's really long and no one wants to listen to the whole thing. So hopefully I've condensed it successfully. This is called Breaking. As soon as we pulled into the driveway of the ranch, I knew my mom had lied. The night before, I stuffed a suitcase with sweatshirts and long underwear for a weekend at a horse ranch in cabins without heat. I cradled the phone between my shoulder and my ear and tried to yank the zipper closed. "Do you promise?" I asked. "Yes," my mom laughed. "You'll be fine." A week before, she had called me from the west coast of Michigan, her voice cutting in and out from a poor signal. "You have to come," she begged. She was calling from a women's retreat at Grace Adventures Ranch with some coworkers, where it rained all weekend while middle-aged women rode horseback on muddy trails and were fed steak and cookies. It had been at least 5 years since I'd ridden regularly, and I missed the smell of leather and hay, the curve of the horse's neck muscle under my palm. Humans bond differently with horses than they do with other animals, if they bond at all. The average horse weighs about 1,200 pounds, almost as much as an automobile. Even a 30-year-old graying carnival horse that moves no faster than a plodding walk is strong enough to kill you. With a sudden jump at the scare of a gunshot or a backward kick to an unseen enemy, a horse is wild again, and leather straps and whips and spurs are useless. When I stand next to a horse, we have an understanding that I will treat her nicely if she will only carry me about tolerating my shifting weight and heels. In return, I trust that she'll submit to the metal pulling at the corners of her mouth, telling her where to go. I trust her to keep me safe and not to throw me to the ground or try not to step on me if I do end up in the dirt. Once, during a lesson when my sister was 14, her horse balked at something we couldn't see and broke into a gallop. She toppled sideways to the ground, and as I rode behind, I dropped my own reins to cover my mouth. She fell toward his hooves, churning sand. When she hit the ground, her horse stopped. Lowering his 100-pound head to sniff at her, he picked up one foot at a time, stepping gingerly over her. He stood next to her while she cried, his white head low. A horse is always a second away from being wild, but you risk, you trust them. When a horse leans his warm head into your arms and you can feel the pulse of a heart much bigger than yours, you think that maybe you can be wild too. Your trust is mutual. You both understand that you will never be what you could be, fearful and violent. My mom offered to pay my way for the upcoming family weekend at Grace Adventures Ranch. After the women's retreat, she insisted that we come and have the fun that she'd had. She was happy to do something, anything, together, and I could not resist the horses or the stakes. But I was concerned about the name, Grace Adventures. The ranch's website showed all of its camps. All were Christian or Bible-centered. I'd attended enough vacation Bible school during my childhood. Since I'd moved out of my home and away from my mom, religion was no longer a part of my life. I did not want to do it again. Are you sure it's not going to be a lot of, you know? I tiptoed around my mom, who sometimes attends Christian lectures, emails me Bible quotes, and tells me that reading Harry Potter is Satan worship, and other times lets her new boyfriend spend the night and jokes about bestiality, pornography. I just don't want it to be a bunch of women praying and hugging and crying. I braced. Oh, she scoffed, it won't be anything like that. I wanted to believe her, but a part of me suspected that horses alone would not have brought her. When we pulled in, I knew. The wooden sign was carved with the words Grace Adventures and the T elongated into a cross. Around the campfire that evening, two men in cowboy hats and chaps flung guitars over their shoulders. I bristled when a ranch hand passed out songbooks. With the first chord, almost everyone around the campfire stood to sing. I would not. I crossed my arms and huffed. I didn't want to be at church camp. My mom pointed to the lyrics to guide me, like I'd lost my place, so I nodded, but did not sing. She watched my lips and moved the songbook back to her lap. She sang under her breath, out of key, and did not look at me. I felt guilt well up in my esophagus. What kind of an asshole doesn't sing? I thought. I took the songbook back. While we sang, I stole glances at the table laden with open packages of donut holes and paper cups of cider. After we were dismissed, I hurried over to stuff my face with the standard post-sermon fare, a reward. You lied, I said to my mom on the way back to our cabin. She shrugged. I really didn't know how it was going to be. Weren't they like this the last time you came? I knew the answer already. I wished that I was not so angry. The next day of our supposed grace adventure, after hours of thankfully sermon-free trail riding, we dropped onto the wooden bleachers next to the outdoor arena. Every hour during the weekend was scheduled for an activity, and from 5 to 6 p.m., Chad the cowboy was going to give a demonstration. Jared, the handsome red-haired ranch hand, held Chad's horse Cruz in the arena while Chad brought a horse in from another pasture. The young Palomino, the blonde of horses with a sandy-colored body and a white mane and tail, pulled the lead rope tight in Chad's fist. Her muscles were taut, and she followed Chad with spasmodic movements, her eyes wide, white. Her neck muscles were contracted, pulling her head high. She wore nothing but a thin rope halter. The metal gate clanged shut, and she jumped in fear, shaking her head, nostrils flared. Chad did not flinch. He stopped in the center of the arena and faced us. The young horse stood close behind him. Her lily-shaped ears flicked back and forth. She was listening. This is Prairie Lady. Beneath his cowboy hat, Chad was mic'd. She is a 4-year-old wild Mustang, rescued. Rescued, I thought. From what? And ladies and gentlemen, he raised a hand to point at us and the horse shied away. She's just like you and me. Her soul is divided into 3 parts. He tapped her between the eyes. Her mind. Right now, he raised his voice and I pictured him at a pulpit. She is fixated here. He tapped again. In her mind. Survival, fear, that's what she's thinking about right now. He moved his hand gently to her twitching shoulder muscle. She didn't move, and I wondered if she trusted him. Her will, Horses carry 60% of their body weight in their shoulders. This is what drives her, supports her. But this, he moved toward her hip and she spun away. He held his hand out and stepped closer. The Mustang stood, accepted his touch, quivering. He patted the top of her round hindquarters. This is where her heart is, in her hips. We want her to move from here, from her own heart. But right now, Chad beckoned the ranch hand. She's not ready for that. He took the other horse, Cruz, from the ranch hand and climbed into the saddle. Shortening the lead rope, he forced the young Mustang close, bumping her shoulder into Cruz's. Nudging Cruz with his heel, Chad pulled the two horses into a tight circle. The young Mustang pulled away with her nose in the air, swinging her hips away. Chad muscled back until she was forced to trot alongside. Her front legs knocked with Cruz's, and I put my hands to my mouth, fearing broken bones. Humanist theory would say that humans are, in their natural state, good. But we know that that isn't true. The Bible tells us that we are born with sin, just as she is. What? I thought. She is dead, he said. The two horses thumped in a circle, jostling. Until she engages her heart and submits to the will of the master, he broke off to grin at the audience. She will remain that way. She reached with bared teeth and bit Cruz. The big black and white Mustang only leaned his shoulder into hers and continued their circling. He too was rescued from the wild. The heavy western saddle looked wrong next to her delicate body. Both wild horses ran nose to nose, and I wondered if she could trust him enough to submit, or if she feared what she would lose when she submitted. The two horses circled, and Chad fell silent, concentrating. His microphone amplified his breathing, and the Mustang's hooves pounded in time. Good girl, he whispered, beautiful girl. He breathed. The young Mustang sneezed in the dust she kicked up. He repeated, good girl, a mantra. Cruz and the wild Mustang were so close that their heads were parallel, their large glassy eyes right next to each other. Their shoulders touched, rubbed. Did she look for trust, for fear, for commiseration in the broken horse's eye? Or did she see nothing but her own wild white eye reflected back? The wild Mustang stretched her neck out, then slowly lowered it, almost to the dirt. Would you look at that, breathed one of the older cowboys in front of me. Did you see that? Chad's voice burst out in a crackle of feedback. Did you see it? Her muscles contracted again and her head was high once more, but her hooves matched the cadence of Cruz's 1-2, 1-2, a measured heartbeat. She submitted. I jumped when the other campgoers on the bleachers broke into quick pops of applause. She followed her heart and submitted to her master. My mom smiled next to me and clapped a muffled applause with her gloved hands. She looked at me and I drew my hands up to clap too. I wondered if she thought I didn't believe because I didn't go to church anymore. I wondered if she expected my heart to lead me back. Chad stopped the two horses in the center of the arena. The Mustang stood still next to Cruz, trembling. Look at her now, he said, and squinted at us through small round glasses. He pointed at her upright neck. She is still afraid, just as we are with God. We are afraid to give our heart to the Lord. We let him in for a second, but then. The Mustang jerked the lead rope in perfect coincidence, or divine inspiration. We returned to our evil state. That's right, said the cowboy in front of me and stroked his white mustache. Heads nodded and bobbed all around. Steam furled out of the Mustang's nostrils as she looked at us. But what has she lost? I wanted to yell. I saw her resistance and her wildness fading. Thank you.
Hi, I'm going to read two poems. The first one is Pastels. Chunks of pastel are all over the table. You're doing because I would have taken them one at a time, putting each back after a stroke. My eyes want to place them back in the box, organize, classify, line them up magenta to blazing pink to ballerina shoe to the color of your mouth. Mauve, but not at all, because mauve can't move the way you do or touch cheekbones lightly as ribbons. And I watch you looking at your paper, smeared with dusty turquoise and pink lemonade ashes, beauty building like a funeral pyre. Your mouth forms the circle of a whistle, but instead of long syrupy notes flutters a mist of crushed pigment suspended on the beams of a bare light bulb. Your thick calloused fingers, blistered from 2x4s, hold the pastel lightly like an infant. You lie on your side, propped up by one elbow, your biceps smooth stones, T-shirt hung from the sides of your chest like sheets pulled tight. Someone should be drawing you. I leave the pastels sitting powdered tangerine to coffee grounds to plum pixie stick dust, wild and without order. And the other poem is Rebirth. There must have been language in the womb. My thin, lucid fingernails must have been pressed to warm ink on pages somewhere, maybe near her rib cage or printed on my umbilical cord, maybe floating, apricot light traveling through the tissue paper skin of my mother's swollen belly. Letters must have been waiting in my mother's eggs, my father's sperm swimming furiously through dim tunnels, carrying the periods, semicolons, commas needed to complete the thought. Because I don't ever remember not knowing how words could sink through my transparent hands and into my blue veins, how they could fertilize my cortexes and lobes and hemispheres, cause them to grow into a network and make me alive. There must have been language when my lids were sealed shut, my eyes bulging like black marbles behind them. I must have known the words to say when I felt her inside shaking and rolling before I lost them. The words must have been resting on the back of my tongue, my lips shaping the sounds to say, stop, I'm not ready for this, just a little more time. But there was pressure and tugging and sterile light. All of my words were wiped away with my blood and chalky casing until the only syllables I could sound were screams. I lost every word in the birth canal and on the table and on the white tiled floor. I'm only now beginning to find exactly where they landed, cup them in my hands, and breathe them in. Thank you.
Hi, I'm Brittany. I'm reading a fiction piece called Kicking Sawdust. I'm just going to read the first part, so that should give you a gist. When I was 5 years old, my mom told me about the magic of birthday wishes. I was skeptical, even at that young age, but she made me believe. If they don't come true at first, she said, it's only because they're not strong enough yet. That year, I learned that a five-year-old wish wasn't strong enough for a pony or a father. It was only good for a stuffed animal and a Ken doll. From then on, I only wished for small things, easy things, things that almost didn't need a wish at all. Mom promised and promised that by the time I turned 18, my wishes would be strong enough for anything. She raised me to believe that life would become perfect and adult-like the minute I blew out 18 candles. Today, I will find out if all her hype is true. Mom was early to make the traditional chocolate chip birthday pancakes, but not early enough, which is also traditional. She's always running behind. I sit at the small table squeezed next to the kitchenette, scraping the last bite around my plate to soak up all the remaining syrup. No cake? No wish? I ask. We must still have time for a quick birthday song and a gift unwrapping or two? Not now, after the show. Mom flutters around me in her purple silk robe, hunting for her other shoe and the cap to her lip gloss. She works full time for Brick Oswald's Funtime Traveling Circus, a job that she has held herself since she was 18. She is supposed to be ready a few hours before they call doors and the marks start coming in, which was about 5 minutes ago. I work too, where and when I'm needed, which is usually stuck behind the curtains pulling rigging. On weekends, I get to tumble and juggle and stunt in the big top between acts. I've clowned a few times, but it's not as fun, and I'm not allowed to breathe fire. I tried once. My beard caught, and Mom had to tackle me, whacking my chin with her suit coat to put out the flames. She smiles, a fleeting quirk of her lips, and gently flicks at my chin. You have crumbs in your beard. You should comb it again. Mom is constantly preoccupied with my beard care regimen. She corrects the length and direction of my comb strokes and clucks her tongue at me if I forget to use conditioner. There are always oblong vials of liquids and pastes in muted colors waiting on the bathroom counter, marked with pink post-its reading, lather me in and rinse out after 5 minutes, or leave me on overnight. Keeping up the shine and curl of her own beard takes up most of her time, but she always manages to find more to worry about mine. And make sure you clean all of this up before you leave. She backs away, absently waving her hand at the sticky bowls and spoons left over from breakfast, and I presume last night's cake baking. What on earth did she need a colander for, and how did she manage to get it so filthy? Have a great birthday, Vivian. She gives me a final smile, one big enough to disappear into the fringes of her beard, before she ducks out of our trailer, leaving me with only a full sink for company. I wish that she had been right after all, and that turning 18 would grant me the wondrous power of scouring the filth off dishes with only my eyes. I squint to intensify my glare and think dirt incinerating thoughts, all to no avail. Out the small window above the faucet, I can see beyond the trailers to the back of the tents and the cluster of lot lice starting to form around them. There's a Mexican girl, about 4 or 5, in a lumpy pink sweater, riding on her father's shoulders to the line of porta-johns back by the cages. She soars above the crowd, eyes wide, as she meets the elephants and the tigers and the fancily bridled ponies for the very first time. I wish I could be there with her, could be her, out having adventures, away from this trailer and the hungry-eyed crowds and the snow globe-like prison of the circus. Even with my pending 18-year-strong wish, that future looks impossibly far away. The only adventure I'm going to have this morning is surfing plastic bowls and wooden spoons over soap suds. Thank you.
Fuck, dude. Fuck, dude. I still remember when you denounced God on the floor of my apartment on St. Patrick's Day, fuzzy from too much whiskey. We found that Bible asleep in an empty wooden drawer, and you picked it up to let it fall to the ground like rain accumulated into a single drop, where it broke into a puddle of words confused on the carpet. You laughed, and so did I, but we knew there was nothing funny about your loss of faith. We're all depressed, but not you too, Mike. You, who never met a girl you didn't love. I think I'm the only guy who's here to read. I feel a little bit strange about that. But, all right, this next poem's called Footprints. Every place I go, there's a voice, dead man walking. This shadowed night walk, twisting, slowly like a worm through an apple, holding hands with half moon yellow phantom. I'll walk this city inside out. I'll walk this city until my feet grind down into nothing, like a piece of chalk in the hand of a student. After school, writing, I will not stare out the window 1,000 times on the chalkboard. But tonight, right now, all I want to know is, how can Los Angeles, Detroit, London, Vancouver, and this little city all bend the same in the night underneath Orion's belt? Poetry has us tied to its back and jumps from skyscrapers. We're all going down. Pockets filled with dynamite, 2:17 a.m. Windows pass, some lit, luminous blinks. Full moon free fall, moments as fireflies, on, then off, hanging in city air, caught in its shirt. Heart pressed against the back of the ribcage, walking spinal cord, bone tightrope. Gut in the tips of toes, shaking, shoelaces helpless, untied. Broken wing, busted parachute. One headlight, red pickup yawning across empty city road, blank page. We fall toward it like a pencil in a trembling hand.
My name is Kelly Hannon, and I'm reading the Dead Dead essay. I shortened it a little for everybody here today. Writing the Dead Dead essay was never my intention. I hate the Dead Dead essay. I hate its sentimentality and the box it places me in. I hate being the Dead Dead girl, or Dead Dead woman, as I suppose I should start calling myself. But he is dead, and I am writing this essay, and hating the facts doesn't change them. I've tried writing about other aspects of my life. I tried write about being the only girl on an all-boy t-ball team when I was 7. Describing how they moved in from the outfield or sat down when I came to bat, and my frustration with myself for not being able to sail the ball 20 feet over their heads. But if I wrote the T-ball story, I would remember how I only joined the team to please my dad, how I liked the car rides alone with him to the games, and how badly I wanted to make him proud. The events of the summer following my freshman year of college would make a great memoir. Through June, July, and August, I drove an hour to Ann Arbor every week to do yard work for my know-it-all Aunt Ginny's small business. I grew to loathe the city, all forms of gardening, and her. For 3 months, I tried to convince her that I understood getting married would not resemble playing house, a term I detest. But in writing about that summer, I would not be able to forget about how my dad was not there to tell his older sister to shut up, or to tell me stories of her bossy behavior during childhood, and his nickname for her, Ginny the Pig. I also cannot forget how he never got a chance to meet the man I spent that summer defending my right to marry, my husband Dan. I hate the Dead Dad essay, and yet I cannot write about my childhood without writing about my father. Perhaps it's because all of my childhood memories revolve around him. Perhaps it's because the day he died was the day my childhood ended. Or perhaps it's because even though I only saw him every other weekend, focusing on a time when he was not around feels like a betrayal to his life. I spent a much larger portion of my childhood with my mother than with my father. When my parents divorced, I was 2 years old, and my father had already moved out, but only around the block. His new backyard and my mother's backyard connected, and I never had to leave my own property to visit him. Growing up, I thought this was every family's situation. On the trip home from kindergarten one afternoon, I enlightened my mother with an astounding fact. "Mom, guess what? Matt's parents live in the same house." She tells me she was shocked, not at the newfound fact itself, but that she had a daughter to whom a nuclear family was abnormal. My family situation was never a problem with my friends. My small Catholic grade school was very open-minded about divorce, and I was not the only child from a so-called broken home. I had friends and parties, got good grades, played sports, and joined the student council. Overall, my childhood was happy, until it ended. Here are the facts. Ages, me 11, dad 43, although the obituary read 44. He made it to my birthday that year, but not his own. Date, May 7th, 1995, a date that remained fuzzy for months after the event. I had to ask my mother which day he died multiple times before my brain would commit it to memory. Location, me, Anaheim, California, with my mother and grandmother to see Disneyland. Dad, Williamston, Michigan, following his girlfriend home from their date. Cause of death, car crash and a heart attack. No one was ever sure about the order in which these events occurred, or maybe no one wanted to tell an 11-year-old child the details. Facts are easy to state and relatively easy to understand. On the evening of May 7th, a man died in a car crash after running into a large tree. That man was Michael Hannon, my father. But while these facts are true, they don't represent the truth, not entirely. The truth is harder, messier. Facts are lists and bullet points. Facts can be memorized and regurgitated. But the Dead Dad essay is not about facts. It is about the truth and the feelings and emotions that come into play when a young girl finds herself in California without a father. The Dead Dad essay is about how that young girl will always wonder if her father remembered to wear a seatbelt that night, a life-saving device she often had to remind him to use. If she had been in the car, or at least seen him off for the night, could the reminder have saved him? The Dead Dad essay is about a young woman hoping the man she looked up to as a god when she was small did not drive drunk that night. Family history has taught her that her father's side is full of alcoholics, and he probably drank more than she realized. The Dead Dad essay involves tears and a tight throat and moves beyond facts into an uncomfortable new world. After my dad died, I took a few weeks off school and went to his funeral. Although I do not remember inviting them, my entire fifth grade class attended in their stupid school uniforms, and I hated them for it. None of them knew him when he was alive. Why were they here now that he was dead? I attended the burial and the wake and then continued on with my life, because that is what you do. I was not dead, my mother was not dead. I was only halfway to being an orphan, and so we continued on. I went to group grief counseling for a few months, but it didn't help. The therapy experience resembled the world's most depressing potluck dinner. Every Wednesday, my mother and I would bake lemon poppy seed muffins from a box and go to therapy until I finally begged her to let me stop. Bringing a dish to pass and sitting in a circle with strangers was never my idea of help. Even as a child, I disliked sharing emotions I considered weak. My dad was dead. Talking about how I felt and drawing pictures of activities we both enjoyed wasn't going to change anything. I knew in my heart he would never read the message scrawled on a small strip of paper attached to a red helium balloon and released into the sky. Listening to the other children talk about losing siblings and friends didn't make me feel understood. Maybe I didn't want to be understood. As an only child, I was the only one who had a dead dad. My mother lost an ex-husband. His siblings lost a brother. His friends lost a great guy. I lost my dad. He was my dead dad, and I didn't want to share him. This was the first time in my life I ever wanted siblings, and also the first time I was happiest not to have them. I wanted to have someone to turn to for memories where mine had gaps. Someone who saw him as I saw him, half God and half man. A hero who could do no wrong. But I only wanted puppet brothers and sisters. I wanted to bring them out when I was unsure where we went camping in Canada, and I wanted them to go away again when reliving the stone beach and blazing campfire. I wanted to be the only person he taught to fish, standing together in our backyard with my brand new Snoopy fishing pole. I wanted siblings to remind me the pole was yellow, but I wanted them gone while learning to cast into the long grass, laughing as our cat chased the key tied to the end of the line. I wanted someone to share in my grief, and at the same time, I wanted to hold it tightly and shout, "It's mine." As my father became dead for years instead of months, I expected to think of him less often. I adjusted to not having him around and accepted my inability to change my situation. But the acceptance of his death was superficial, and I couldn't help the childish hope he was still alive somewhere, the hope that I hadn't lost him forever and someday he would return. As I silently hoped for him to still be alive, I tried to live a life that would make him proud. But I never knew how to make him proud. My dad died too soon for me to understand the kind of man he was. Few people are willing to speak ill of the dead, so I am often stuck with my godlike images from childhood. I know he was not a god, but I also know almost nothing of him as a man. The few facts I have gleaned over the years often go against my memories of idyllic summers and weekends. In my memories, he is amazingly tall, a giant next to a small girl, his head blocking out half the sky. If he were alive today, he would only be 1 inch taller than my 5'11" husband. Tall, but not in danger of hitting his head walking through doorways. My memory tells me he was a genius. Math problems could stump me for days and he would fly through them in minutes. But children don't take calculus. Would he have been able to impress me with a vast knowledge of differential equations? Or would he have scratched his head in wonder? Alive today, he would probably be bald. No shiny black hair parted just so. Maybe he would have traded in contacts for glasses, thicker and easier for an old man to wear. And he would be an old man. I can't picture him old. The few hairs remaining turned gray with age, wrinkles lining his face, his back bent from decades of yard work. That man is not my father. When I picture him alive today, he is in his mid-40s. I don't want him to be old. I want his life to have been paused. I still hope to look up at just the right second and catch him walking into view. Even in high school, at an age where childish fantasies are put to rest, I pictured him walking into the cafeteria to scoop me up into his arms and tell me he had never wanted me to leave. Years later, at my wedding, I hope to see him stroll into the garden during this reception to shake my husband's hand and congratulate us. I remember looking off toward the parking lot, squinting into the setting sun, while holding my husband's hand, projecting the image of an adult over the hopes of a child, wishing a man dead 10 years would re-enter my life. I never told anyone about these stories because I knew it was a ridiculous concept. If I spoke my dream aloud, the magic would dissolve and I would be left alone, with no hope of life after death or life instead of death. After 12 years in the Catholic school system, I have given up on God and heaven. After 14 years of being the dead dad girl, I don't know how to give up on him. And I don't know how to write the dead dad essay. In many ways, I'm still the child I was when he died. I still want him to come back. I still shy away from sharing my feelings. I don't tell people about how sometimes, after a perfectly happy day, I sit on my bed while tears flow endlessly down my face. How over a decade after his death, I am still so suddenly overcome by grief, I sometimes don't make it to the privacy of my bedroom. How I sink to the cool tiled floor of the kitchen or bathroom, sobbing uncontrollably, my chest so tight it is difficult to breathe. And then how I wipe my tears away with cold water when I hear my husband's car pull into the driveway, just like I used to hide my tears from my mother. I don't know how to reveal these secrets. People are uncomfortable with death, and the inevitable "I'm so sorry" irritates me. I don't want to be pitied. I don't want you to be sorry. My dead dad makes me different. It pushes me away from people who have never suffered tragedy, and sometimes I push them away too. This is not how my dead dad essay was supposed to end. It has told too much and headed for territory I want to keep hidden, exposing a wound still red and raw. Even worse, the dead dad essay has no conclusion. My father will still be the central point of my childhood. At times, I will still sob into my pillow when the grief abruptly crushes my heart. I will still hide my pain. I will still miss my father. I will still hate this essay.
So now we're going to turn to our first place winners. I don't know if Megan Pullum's here for screenwriting, but if not, Jill Kolongowski is going to read Lindsay Sloan's first place creative nonfiction piece, and then Leslie Anderson will read poetry, and Nicole Taylor will finish off the evening with some fiction. Okay.
I'm Lindsay Sloan. No, just kidding. I talked to her on the phone today, so we decided so the cuts that are made are hers and not mine, so I'll try and do it justice. I have inherited my father's petty compulsions. Aside from the animals, I gather the same things he does, the staples of collecting, coins, marbles, stamps. Many of my collections were started by my father, the way neighbors share tomato plants. Every so often, he gave me the beginnings of new collections, a jar half full of marbles, a small leather pouch of wheat pennies. And to these small foundations, I would add and add until I had amassed an assortment he might find acceptable. We'd sit on his bed, and I'd let the contents of my jar spill forth, a pile of coins from across the globe and across the century, steel pennies from World War II, yen, pesos, and pounds. He'd sift through them with his rough hands and say, "I have something for you," before pulling a buffalo nickel from his pocket and tossing it into the pile. This was a prelude, and I waited patiently as he turned the discs of copper and silver and bronze over in his palms. I was there to see the holy grail of coin collecting, one of my father's most prized possessions, the Deutschmark from the Third Reich. Dirt dark and small as a dime, an eagle clutching a swastika branded onto its surface. The coin was handed to him one day as change, and for my 20th birthday, it was handed to me in a pristine white jewelry box tied with a blue ribbon. I like to think that my father pushed me to collect so that we could have something in common, aside from our love of baseball and John Wayne. As I get older, I've begun to resent the perfection of his plan. The only way to get someone to take care of your junk once you're gone is to recruit someone who cares about the same junk that you do. My father intended to raise a treasure keeper. My collecting didn't bother me until I came to college. I never gave it a second thought. It was just something I did, like reading ingredients or tying my shoes. Even the original process of packing each collection and carrying it to my dorm room freshman year didn't seem so bad. Over the course of my next 10 moves, however, the extra packing and weight began to matter. But the looks I got from friends and strangers were what really made me realize that collecting is odd. People see me bending down to pick up a penny in the middle of a busy four-lane, and they start to wonder. The funny thing about people is that they expect explanations. Curiosity is relentless. I get questions about cutting stamps off envelopes at work or saving bottle caps or wine corks at dinner. I find I have to explain myself repeatedly, grasping for some justification for the why of it all. The fact that no why ever comes to the surface has me doubting myself. Is it the compulsion to collect that comforts me? It is the compulsion to collect that comforts me, not the things I amass. What are these things and why do I need them? And more importantly, if I wanted to, could I stop? I worry the answer is no. I worry that collecting is a part of my genetic makeup, something passed down from my father, as inescapable as his short stature. But how to rid myself of these ties to the past? The options seem endless. A garage sale is appealing, but too much work. A Viking burial is intriguing, but first I would have to pack it all into my trunk and drive to the lake, which is, again, too labor-intensive. The drive may give me too much time to doubt myself, to reconsider. I could burn it all in a great fire, a ritual cleansing. But what if some things didn't catch? I'd be left with bits of charred metal and half-melted coins, feeling guilty just to discard the remains. I could store these things indefinitely, rent a temperature-controlled box off of a lonely industrial road, but this would cost money, and I've invested enough. My mother has informed me that she is tired of hoarding my junk. My father's house is out of the question. No space, and besides, things are liable to be sold piecemeal with my stepmother lurking around. My father's collections have been left unscathed, which I attribute to his paying the mortgage. I can't help but wonder if, stripped of his collections, who he would become. Would he be left intact, or would the process hollow him out until, like a deflating pool, he caved in on himself? I know that beating her to it, selling what I can, seems slightly more logical than burying each collection as its own entity, or burying it all en masse. You might be just as surprised as I was that among the lovely buyers of eBay, there's strikingly little demand for pre-read fortunes or poorly torn Will Ferrell movie stubs. Aside from market considerations, there's the part of me that feels like separating the collections would be a form of amputation. The sum of its parts make up something greater than a simple sum. They make up a part of me. The first quarter of my life distilled to its petty possessions. And besides, if I sold it, no one would be able to dig it up. There would be no legacy, no chance for me to change my mind. These things were meant to be left behind for those who will be want to wrap their fingers around something once I'm gone. I live in a nation of collectors, of monuments and shrines, museums and plaques. Do we collect because we are afraid of forgetting, afraid the past will slip through our fingers and be forgotten, lost among the clang of loose change? Or do we collect because we don't know how to let go, because we're unable to tell when it's time to move on? I've never been good at letting things go. I harbor grudges, and I can't stop bringing up the hack job my sister performed on my hair when I was 3. Look, I say, it still grows uneven. I hold on to my darkest memories, revisit them, hoping their pain will tell me something new, enlighten me, teach me some higher truth. I write essays hoping to glean an understanding of the past. To let go is to move forward. I must free myself from my past, from the weight of my collected memories, my emotional clutter, before I can become someone new. The narrator in Chuck Palahniuk's Fight Club warns, the things you own end up owning you. He's right. Before evolution, I must declutter, become a leaner version of myself, a more economical being. I must make space in my life for what is to come next. It strikes me that this will not be a simple operation. Throwing the boxes in the kitchen trash will not suffice, and besides, there's enough to fill it several times over. After nights of sleepless contemplation, I've settled on a proper burial in my father's backyard, beneath the flower bed next to the garage. And should he feel the need, he can watch over my things. My friend Anna suggested that I get a treasure chest, and I find the idea appealing. But my things are not treasure, not even to me, and anyone digging up is going to be disappointed by such a grandiose presentation. Each box and tin will have its own final resting place. In place of eulogy, I will read the Chinese fortunes one by one, burying them last. There's something romantic in this symbolic death, like boxing up the remnants of a failed relationship and exiling the boxes to the far corner of the town dump. I think the collectors who came before me would be proud. I'll draw a map with dotted lines and a thick red X to leave behind as my last will and testament. I think of my father's wishbones. I count the time he has spent accumulating them, a lifetime of holiday dinners, building his collection slowly year after year. I think of the formation of coral reef, years of growth measured in centimeters, decades measured in inches. Collecting might be an unbreakable addiction. I could stay clean for a year before one day surreptitiously stooping to pick up a coin off the sidewalk, and the next find myself in an alley surrounded by heaps of marbles and stamps. But that glimpse of freedom, no matter how fleeting, it's too tempting to resist. For so long, all I've wanted was for my father to share his wishes with me. I wanted just once to stop collecting and enjoy. I wanted to break the bones apart instead of preserving them. I wanted to discard the pieces. I like to think I've been saving all of these things for something huge and important, a wish to end all wishes.
Because you gave me a microphone, I'm going to talk for a minute. As most of you know, I'm graduating and leaving Michigan at the end of this year, so I just wanted to take a moment to thank everyone in the Arts and Letters Department, all my professors, the faculty, and all of the talented writers that I have had the opportunity to work with. My family has supported me, and especially Diane Wachowski, whose presence in my life has just been a gift, and without whom I would not be half the writer or student or person that I am today. So, thank you. And without further ado, Michigan Inaugural. In another day, I find our magic, America, stumbling to the carcass of my car, mumbling incantations of rebirth, my head held under the wet morning, thrashing through snowdrifts. And somewhere people are cheering, waving open hands like throats of radiant birds, willing another inch, another save, straining against each other's wills, weaving netted walls of wiry premonitions, tearing at the other proud and intricate cages. And somewhere a mind leans over a table and paper, stares an idea into being. Behind the twitching, onion-root nerves, it spreads a single petal. The mind fights the urge to tear at the thing, dig out the brilliant center, green, dripping, wet, and new. It opens and opens. And between the ley lines of cornfields, a windmill spins, a colossal whirligig of the imagination. And the people below it do not completely understand, but they believe in it. It turns. A light burns into existence. It's magic. And I have touched the spellbound pages of filled circles or pressed buttons or paper strips or checks or crosses which mean I want, I need, I think. And I believe in the beautiful arcane of that becoming. It is the golden alchemy of stretching backs and twisting hands, copper, cobalt, silver, amethyst, bruised hides of man, making these impossible movements of stone up, water backwards, art and words pulled like bewildered doves from nothing, everything air. The shuddering engine of ultimate magic, America. A fluttering breath, and another, and another. The Meeting of the Worm Shepherds. After the funeral, the night fell by the handful. My uncle sat in my grandparents' backyard, which was now my grandmother's. We spoke of stars and dead poets. In thin black jeans and smelling like smoke, though he'd told everyone he quit. I said nothing about the ashes by the doorstep. I put a flower pot over them. His black dog wandering through the garden like slow-drying lava sighed, settled between us like a heavy question. My mother always blamed him for dragging her sister through his personal darkness, but I was not afraid of him because he was like me, slowly turning the yard into a valley of myths. Already bits of fireflies were falling away like slag. The pile of empty bottles smoldered into porch-lit brimstone. I grew feathers inside my running shoes. But this happens to us all the time. Our words wiggled away from our mouths through the gritty moment, began to break down all the death into a black silk pall. And the last one, Eulogy for Spirit and Opportunity. For those of you who don't know, Spirit and Opportunity are the two rovers that are currently exploring Mars. The rovers are dying on Mars. Their brother has already gone dark and buried. Their springs and bolts and cogs drop into the red sand. Their cameras clog with dirt. Their wheels freeze. They limp up hills and spread their solar panels like hospital blankets. The technicians do not tell them about budget cuts or questions of purpose. They say, "Everything here is fine, right if you find water." Remember you told me your ancestors dragged themselves from New York to California? They arrived with half a breath, bleeding and sweating. Their great-granddaughter took the train in a few hours. This is our desperate human tension. Footprints wiped clean by the graceless and subtle two-step of time. Progress is a spiral. An aggravated phoenix setting itself up for combustion, the grueling movement around a planet forward, which is also backward. Remember always the Mars rovers. May we travel so far as we can, till our joints fill with the dust of strange places and our children struggle back to our old ruins, assuring those we left behind, there is still no end of the world. Thank you.
Hi. Pardon me. I'm Nicole Taylor, and my story is called In the Valley, and I'm going to read from the very end, as backwards as that seems. Fee wasn't sure if it was morning. She had slept, but the quality of light coming in from the window was more or less unchanged. There were no clocks in the room, and the TV didn't work. There was a King James Bible in the bedside drawer, but she didn't bother to pick it up. She knew it all by heart. But Fee had never particularly liked that saying. She knew it by bone, broken and long in the mending. She knew it by flesh, burned pink. Her heart was hidden and underneath. It did not even enter into it. She was standing in front of the cloudy mirror, washing her face, when she realized she couldn't feel her pulse anymore. She pressed two fingers painfully to her neck and remembered turning Joshua over, the slack feel of his throat, the absence. "Why did you come here?" asked the little girl from Fee's bed. Today her hair was clipped awkwardly in two barrettes, and she was wearing a green shirt with April from the Ninja Turtles on it. Fee hadn't heard her come in. "Get your skates off my bed," Fee ordered. "They're dirty." "So is the bed." The girl rolled her skates absentmindedly over the dimpled coverlet. "Do you know what people do here?" She did not give Fee time to answer. "Sex," she said with all the lascivious drama of a daytime soap opera. Fee pushed her in roller-skated feet off the edge of the bed and sat down beside her, staring at her own bare legs and unpainted toenails. "Did your mom do that?" the girl asked, reaching out to touch the pink scars revealed by Fee's tank top. Fee flinched away from her touch automatically, as she always did, even after all these years, even after Joshua, who said he couldn't imagine her without her marks, said they were as essential as her eyes or her mouth. "Yeah," Fee answered shortly. "Wow, you must have been a really bad kid." The girl sounded eager and fascinated. She looked up at Fee expectantly. Fee looked back at her and saw the knowing in her eyes, felt the familiar, terrified silence fill up her throat, choke her out like thick black mud. "Don't come in here again," Fee whispered. "But it's not really a love story," Joshua said, scrambling eggs with the easy abandon of one who has done it 1,000 times before. "It's about sacrifice. We want Orpheus to succeed, but it's hard not to wonder if he really deserves to succeed." Green peppers fell lightly from his fingers. They were Fee's favorite. "He didn't lose anything or give anything up." He scraped at the pan with a white spatula. "We don't like it when people are just handed things. We like a little suffering and strife in our stories." It was some kind of storm. Fee could hear it falling down on the roof of the motel. She wondered if the laughing women were out in the downpour. She imagined them soaking wet, cigarettes improbably glowing. But maybe the water would just turn to steam against their skin. Maybe it would all evaporate away. Fee didn't hear the door open or close, and she didn't see the girl. She just felt her hand, cold and small, on her bare shoulder. "I don't like the storms," the girl said as Fee rolled over. Fee closed her eyes tight and counted to 15. When she opened her eyes, the girl was still there, wearing a t-shirt two sizes too big and carrying a doll so old that the face had rubbed off. Fee lifted up the cheap, stiff motel blankets and felt the cold of the room settle on her skin, raising stubborn goose flesh as slowly the girl climbed in beside her. For a few minutes, they lay very still with their backs to one another. Fee listened and listened, but she could not pick out the sound of the little girl's breathing. "Why did your mom put those marks on your arm?" the girl asked finally, almost hesitantly, as if remembering the abrupt way Fee had reacted before. Fee took a long breath, She could feel the burning push of it deep down in her lungs. She said I had devils in me, Fee told her, her lips pressed close against the scratchy pillow. We had a fireplace. We had these pokers. Afterwards, her mother would take her into the bathroom and set her on the toilet and look at her, eyes so full of love and sadness. You know that I have to, don't you, baby girl? She would say, dabbing Neosporin on her arm so, so delicately. Fee would rather have gotten hit, gotten burned, until there was no part of her left unmarked than watch her mother weep and apply bandages and wipe away the tears that landed on Fee's skin with one trembling finger. Fee turned over with rustling difficulty. The girl's back was a small white curl in front of her. Why do you call yourself Snow White? Fee asked her softly. Because someday I'm going to wake up and leave away from here, the little girl told her, and she didn't sound very much like a little girl at all. Why do you call yourself Fee? She shot back. Fee shrugged into the papery sheets. Everyone always thought it was short for Fiona anyway, even Joshua. She said she gave me that name to remind me. The girl turned over until she was facing her, small face, half buried in a green pillowcase. Fear of God, the girl whispered, her voice shaping the words with a strange sort of reverence, like a prayer. I had other things to remind me, Fee said. I miss my mom. The girl buried her face in the stiff pillow. When she looked up, she was crying. Her face was still dirty. The tears made dark streaks and black puddles on her skin. Why did you come here? The girl asked her one more time. Because I couldn't be anywhere that he's not. I won't get better. I won't forget him. I won't survive. I'm either going to bring him back or go with him, but I can't go back alone. The girl searched her face. Nobody ever comes here for me, she said. Fee reached out slowly with one arm, touched a hand to the girl's angular shoulder. She realized belatedly that the child was not even a little bit wet. Sometimes when I was upset, my mother and I used to pray. The girl was not cold now, and she gave off a sweaty, radiant heat as she struggled closer to Fee. She smelled like dirt and leaves. She smelled like she'd been lying unregarded on some forest floor. Did it help? She asked. Fee nodded. Sometimes. She thought about her mother's fierce, sleepy face and the wild halo of her hair. Put your problems in God's hands, baby girl. He can carry so much more than you can. She used to press Fee's hands between her own, warm and safe and close. Fee smiled at the girl. She grinned uncertainly in return. Give me your hands, she said. I don't think that's right. Fee sliced two brown pieces of toast into little triangles. Joshua looked curiously at her. I don't think it is about sacrifice. I think it's about faith. Orpheus lacked it, so he lost the woman he loved. Well, he was pretty justified, don't you think? They were trying to screw him over, Joshua argued as the pancakes burned. He never knew when to flip them. Fee shook her head and spread grape jelly across the toast. That's kind of the point of faith. You believe even when it might be smarter not to. Fee waved the butter knife in the air, searching for words. If he really loved her enough to walk into hell for her, and she died, he wouldn't have anything left but faith. She smiled at Joshua. My mother used to say that faith was the thing you have left when you don't have anything left. Joshua gave her his wary look, the one he reserved for those rare times when she mentioned her mother. Fee grinned at him reassuringly, though, and licked the jelly from the knife like a child to show that she was not sad and was not angry. Her mother had been wrong about a lot of things, but if there was anything she had been an authority on, it was faith. As hard, as sharp, and as eternal as diamonds. The girl was gone when Fee woke up, and there was sunlight creeping in through the cracks in the heavy curtains. The drawer on the bedside table was open, and the King James Bible was too. There was a note in narrow, precise handwriting that was totally unlike the scrawl in the key tags. "Cleaned your trunk," it said, "and left something for you in the back seat." There were two dark smears, like tiny wheel tracks, in the carpet by the door. Fee stood up and opened the curtains. The sun hurt her eyes.
"I've always loved you and made you happy, and nothing else could in between."
The woman on the radio had a voice like gravel suspended in honey. Fee turned the radio up as loud as she could. There was something rustling in the back seat. She put the key in the ignition and reached up, turning the rearview mirror, until it reflected only her own mouth. It was smiling and cherry red, pomegranate purple. The gas pedal felt good underneath her insistent foot, and ahead of her, the road vanished into the flat, peerless blue of the sky. It was all up from here. Thank you.
Again, we'd like to thank you all for coming out tonight, and thank you for that excellent reading. This attests to the quality of work we have in our department these days, and we'll just give one more round of applause for the excellent writing we've heard tonight. Appreciate it.